supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Today's show is taped, so don't call in. But we've put together a summer reading list of books to think about how we live our lives, how others live their lives, and the common bond of humanity. We're going to start with Rachel Simon. She's the award-winning author of 6 books and a nationally recognized public speaker on issues related to diversity and disability. Her titles include the bestsellers The Story of Beautiful Girl and Riding the Bus with My Sister. And I am so happy to call her my friend and to see her face to face again here in the studio. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Dan. It's a joy to be here.
So I want to talk about this business of memoir.
Yes.
What is it about memoir that people love? They love to read other people's stories.
You know, I think it's really a pretty recent phenomenon. I think up until pretty much This Boy's Life by Tobias Wolff and Mary Carr's The Liars Club in the late 80s and early 90s, when we thought of memoir, we thought of them in the plural, memoirs, and they were written by famous statesmen and movie stars and that kind of thing. And then Tobias Wolff and Mary Carr came out, and they were just regular people who were excellent writers who wrote about childhood, hardscrabble childhood, and the kind of things that a lot of us went through. And then this was followed up by Angela's Ashes by Frank McCourt. And I think at that point people said, wow, regular people can tell their stories. How fabulous.
So we read them to find ourselves.
I think in a way we read them to live their lives. And it opens up our own lives because we realize points of connection while learning about things we didn't know.
Yeah, about ourselves and about what it means to be human. I mean, you know, I love fiction just for the reason that, you know, I can climb in somebody else's skin knowing it's not real and there's nothing personal to learn out of it usually. But nonfiction, real people, you can always connect at so many levels with these characters.
Yes, and I think one of the big things that happened is that writers of renown were using novelistic techniques to tell their own story. So it wasn't, I did this, I did that. It was throwing you into scenes with a difficult stepfather or being poor in Ireland.
Or a young man who was in a psychiatric institution named Homan in The Story of Beautiful Girl.
Yes, and now that's actually a novel, but it is...
That's what I mean.
Yes. Oh, okay, so you're making the shift from memoir to fiction. Yes. Now, The Story of Beautiful Girl, and I do need to correct that, not a psychiatric institution, an institution for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, but the character of Homan was based on a real person whose story I read about in a book, and then springboarded from that into a fictional story about this man, a real-life person, falling in love with a woman in the institution and them breaking out to escape along with a secret baby and all of the drama that happens after that. So really, that had nonfiction roots, that book.
I have to tell you, though, I mean, the reason, I called it one of the best novels I ever read. I still do. Mm-hmm. But
thank you.
The story is real and true.
Yeah.
You know, these institutions for people with intellectual disabilities are institutions, as you know from your own experience with your sister, Cool Beth.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And what happened, what you described, is real.
Yes.
You know, maybe or maybe not the baby part, but it's real.
Yes.
People fall in love. They're dissuaded from falling in love.
Right.
And all of the inhumanity, all that's real. And to read that novel and to be upset about the inhumanity, the injustice, to fall in love with those characters and see the humanity in them,
no.
I mean, that's a real experience. It's a very real human experience, even though the story is roughly fictional.
Well, I really appreciate you saying that. Certainly when I wrote it, nothing could have been more real to me than the world of that book. So that's kind words. I appreciate them.
So let's talk about memoir writing. Yours, mine, others.
Mm-hmm.
How do you write a memoir? I happen to know you go into kind of this writer's never land where you are inaccessible.
Yeah, that's true. Which I'm in right now, coming out of it to meet with you today, and that's because of something else I'm working on. But, well, I think initially you have to have a story that you feel really needs to be told, and it's not your whole life story, but a piece of your life that you think is really important, and then figuring out how to tell it, and then you just commit yourself to really working on it day after day after day.
Riding the bus with my sister.
Riding the bus with my sister.
You might be best known for that. It was very powerful and very poignant, and it was very much about your life, her vulnerabilities, yours. What was it like kind of opening yourself up like that?
That's a great question. You know, the book goes back and forth between the present and the past. And in the present, we're riding the bus together, and I'm struggling to accept her on her own terms and dealing with my own anger. The past is a dramatic story having to do with a lot of trauma and drama in my childhood family. And that's the part that readers always say, how did you feel about writing that, and was that difficult? That was actually not difficult to write, because I'd actually written a previous memoir that never got published and kind of worked all the emotional and creative and technical issues through in working on that book. But the writing the material in the present, where I was dealing with my anger toward my sister, that was the hard part. How could I reveal these unpleasant parts of myself to a reader? And that took a lot of inner work as well as work on the page.
All right. Tell me as though I'm not a psychologist. What does inner work mean? What translate that into American, please?
Okay. Well, let me give you an example of a particular scene. There's a scene in the book where I had a big blow-up fight with my sister. And actually, I'm not sure if this scene finally made it into the book because of what I'm about to tell you. We'd gone to get her birthday present. I'd given her some money. We went into Walmart. She wanted to buy a T-shirt that I thought had a very mean-spirited message on it. And I said, you can't buy that. And she said, what? It's my birthday. You know, you gave me the money. And we had a big fight. And this is what I wrote. So I wrote the scene. And I showed it to my editor, and she said, you look like a prig. And I said, what? She was buying this nasty shirt. And she said, yeah, but it was her birthday present. And so then my editor and I had the same fight my sister and I had had. And because of the fight with my editor, I realized my sister was right, and that I was essentially trying to control her. And
not essentially, honey.
I was indeed trying to control her. And that became the core message of the book, that I needed to accept her on her own terms and stop trying to control her. And it was only because the fights with my sister and my editor that made me see that, and therefore the importance of writing those fights and making myself look unflattering.
And that changed you.
It completely changed me as a person. It completely changed me.
I have to tell you, it might be too early to reveal this, but I'm thinking about working on my own memoir.
Uh-huh.
And because a lot of people have told me to write it. And I go into my early childhood, which was fine, you know, but in some detail. Now about my growing up in Pleasantville, New Jersey, and what that was like. But as I get older and I begin to talk about my losses and my injuries, and I found myself maybe last month crying like I have never cried since I was 3 years old. I mean, I don't ever in my conscious life remember crying like that, sobbing like a baby over all my losses, all my injuries, and what God opened up for me. I mean, I've known about this my whole life, but all of the emotions behind it opened up. And whether I finally write this or not, or whether it gets published or not, I mean, the process of it has gotten me much closer to my experience, to my life, to my youth, you know?
Yeah, that's a wonderful thing. Can I say two things in response to that? One is, I think it's important for somebody who wants to write a memoir to recognize that it's not only therapy. So you're not going to write it to do your therapy.
Right.
My recommendation is do your therapy first, or at the least concurrently, because you have to make it work in terms of your craft. And then the other is, it's great that you were crying as you were writing, because there's a writer's truism, which is no tears in the writer, no tears in the reader. So if you're not crying as you're writing a sad scene, your reader's not going to cry. And the same is true with something funny. It's, you have to be so emotionally immersed in that material as you're writing it that the reader will feel the same way.
Well, I appreciate the consultation. I wasn't expecting this little benefit here.
Can't help myself.
Tell me what you're reading. What's exciting to you?
Well, one of the great challenges that I always have as a writer is when I'm actively working on a project, it's very difficult for me to be reading other books that tie in genre-wise with what I'm writing. So if I'm writing fiction, it's difficult for me to read fiction because I am unduly swayed by other writers' styles and their subject matter. So in fact, since I am now deeply immersed in working on a novel, I'm not reading fiction. I'm not reading much in the way of memoir. However, I read an awful lot of journalism, since that's not what I'm writing, and I've been reading poetry, since that's not what I'm writing. So what I'd like to do, to recommend for summer reading for the listeners out there, is two collections of poetry that happen to be written by local authors who are twins, who are both blind, and who are wonderful, wonderful poets. Daniel Simpson is one, and the other is David Simpson, and they've each just in the past several months published a collection of poetry. Daniel Simpson is called School for the Blind, and David Simpson's is called The Way Love Comes to Me.
I looked these guys up. They're also musicians.
They're also musicians. And in fact, Dave recently finished writing a play that's going to be staged very soon. They're remarkably talented, loving, wonderful people, and that comes through in their poetry. One of the advantages to reading collections of poetry, whether or not you don't want to be unduly influenced in terms of your style, is you get these mini stories that take you a minute or two to read. You can read them while you're microwaving your breakfast. And you get a different tone in each one. You get something that sits in your heart all day, gives you images you might not have had, and mixes past and present in a lovely way.
One of those books of poetry, I think, is particularly poignant, since one of the brothers has ALS.
That's correct. Dave Simpson has ALS. He's actually moving toward the end. And I love him, and I do visit him, and it's really great that this book came out while he was still here to see it, and really great that his brother Dan's book also came out while they were able to celebrate together. So all the more reason, I think, for people to read these books, both of them, this summer, while Dave is still here.
Is Dave's poetry about what it's like to have your life winding down?
No, he actually completed this collection before things had moved that way. But he is beginning to work on other poems that do tie in with what he's going through now. So both of the poems in School for the Blind and The Way Love Comes to Me, they cover everything from early childhood when they were brothers, being young together,
and
all the way to
they went to the Overbrook School.
They went
here
to the Overbrook School for the Blind. So School for the Blind, Dan's book, covers a number of incidents that happened there.
But he said both positive and negative.
Both positive and negative, that's true. But both of them, I think one thing that really distinguishes their poems from a lot of others I've read is every single one of their poems, both of them, are just steeped in love. Just like tea steeping to a nice dark color. Both of them, every single poem is steeped in love.
You know, we see this often in memoirs, in stories, that people on who on the surface look like they've experienced terrible adversity wind up talking about love. And when I was first reading that before I had all my adversity, I thought it was like a Hallmark card, but it's real.
It's real.
You do wind up experiencing love.
Yeah.
I do want to mention to listeners that your books, links to your books, these books, and so many others are going to be up on our webpage. I cannot wait, Rachel Simon, to read what you are writing, and I sure hope that you emerge from your cocoon soon.
Thank you.
So we can go out for some of that tea you just talked about.
Thank you. I look forward to clinking our glasses together and toasting literature and love with you, Dan.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And especially for your reading suggestions. Rachel Simon's an award-winning author of 6 books, and we'll be back. We're talking with Alan Locos after this break about his experience surviving a plane crash. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. This is Voices in the Family, right here on WHYY-FM. And we are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Today's show's taped, so don't try to call in, but we're offering you some ideas for your summer reading list and taking a look at some memoirs that can have an impact on our own lives. I'm here with Alan Locos. Some of you may have read about his horrific plane accident on Christmas Day 2012 in Myanmar, formerly Burma. Through the Flames is his memoir about this experience and the human characteristics that carried him through his near-death experience and through his recovery. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
So tell us the story about that plane crash.
My wife and I chose Myanmar, or Burma as it's probably better known, for a place to visit. Partially, we want to support the work of Aung San Suu Kyi, who was trying to lead the country out of a dictatorial-type rule. And also, it was very appealing because the country is just evolving now. It's not filled with tourists. So it was a trip we wanted to take and planned it carefully. We had been there for a week, and then on Christmas Day, scheduled to take a 25-minute flight from Mandalay to a little place called Hiho, and what has been officially called pilot error. Plane came down about a mile short of the runway, crashed into a rice field. On the way down, it sheared through electrical cables that sparked and the plane burst into flame. That was one of the big problems for me. The plane immediately filled with smoke, so we couldn't really see very much. And it was clear that we were going to have trouble getting out the front because we were pretty far back. There was an emergency door that had popped open in the crash. It was engulfed in flames, but my wife and I just made a very quick decision that our best chance was just to try to jump through those flames. So we got over near there. I pushed her out. She got out. And as I attempted to follow her, my leg caught on something, and I couldn't see what because of the smoke. And I was stuck in the fire. And I don't know for how long, and doctors haven't been able to determine how long. It could have been as little as 10 or 15 seconds. It could have been as much as 30 or 40 seconds. But I was burned badly over a third of my body. The terms that they use now are full thickness burns. They don't say third degree anymore. So full thickness burns over a third of your body. Doctor looks at that and says, no, there's no way a person can live through this. And that's the prognosis we received there in Myanmar and then in Bangkok and in Singapore and even in New York City.
So I've got to slow you down here because I have a feeling you've told that story before. So I want to, first of all, I met Susanna right before we went on the air, and physically she looks fine. Was she injured in the crash?
She was, but you don't see it because on impact, when the plane crashed, she suffered broken vertebrae and crushed discs. So she is still dealing with neck injury. And, of course, she's dealing with severe trauma, which I'm not. Because once I was burned, I was out of it. I was either in shock or under medication or whatever. But I really didn't know what was going on for a couple of months.
And before we get to the Alan part of the story, how about the other passengers, Alan?
Well, it was an enormous range. Some walked out without a scratch, and some didn't walk out at all.
So I want to come back to early in the story. You and Susanna are sitting in these seats, and you see what's going on, and there's this black smoke around you. What's that like for you? What's happening in your mind at that time?
One of the things that I remember clearly, and actually I remember most everything that happened, but I just don't remember where and when necessarily. I know that I was calm the entire time, even when I was actually in the fire. Now, I was really scared. I would say I was terrified standing in that fire, but at the same time, I would say that I was calm. I was present to what was happening. I knew what I had to do, even though I didn't know specifically how to free my leg. I knew I had to free it. So there was that interesting balance of terror in a frightening situation and yet calm.
All right. On the surface, I can hear most people listening to what you just said saying, right. I mean, to use those words next to each other, that's an oxymoron. Terror,
well,
and calm.
Yeah, here's the thing. I've been a meditator for more than 20 years, and not a casual meditator, pretty serious. I teach meditation. I lead a large meditation community in New York. So day after day after day of practicing, being focused on what's going on in my mind, what's going on in my body, I would bet, I can't prove this, but I would bet played into that moment. The real situation was tremendous danger. But with that, because my mind, you know, a lot of meditation is mind training. Training the mind to become your ally, to become your tool, rather than this kind of monkey mind that it tends to be.
And at the very least, to train your mind to be less reactive to outside stimuli.
Yes, that as well, absolutely. So in that moment, I'm quite certain that I'm alive because of that element of calm. And yes, it does seem incongruous to say to be in a frightening situation and calm at the same time. It's something that I think one would have to experience for oneself. I've had people tell me, I have a friend who told me she was held up once with someone pointing a gun right at her, and she said she didn't know why. She is a meditator also. She said, I was calm, and I spoke to him in a calm way. And she said to him, let me offer to give you some money, and that's good for me, and that's good for you, and then you're not a criminal. And you have to be calm to be able to think of that. He accepted what she offered, and he walked away. Who knows what would have happened otherwise? So I think that practice, for me, my contemplative practice is meditation in a classical, old way. I think that's one of the ways in which my life was saved.
Yeah, you said one of the ways. Now, I want to talk about that, because we don't know.
Right.
Of course.
Right.
So, you know, you have to wonder about genetics, wonder about premorbid health, your support system, Alan. That's a critical issue.
Yeah, and absolutely.
In addition to having all this love in your life.
Yes, and as you said, we really can't prove things that we can't see. But, you know, if we use logic and say six doctors in four different countries said, I wasn't going to live through this. So, okay, with no disrespect to the Burmese people, but let's say a doctor in Myanmar perhaps doesn't get the medical education that one gets here. Perhaps. I don't know that. But by the time you come through Singapore, which is has a very sophisticated hospital, and then come to New York, and the doctors are saying the same thing, then the reason for so many people asking me, how did this happen? How did you live through it? So I had to look back and see, now, what can I look at? What can I investigate for myself to try to answer those questions? And that's really why I wrote the book. I didn't write the book to tell about a plane crash. I wrote the book to try to help people, because I think we all go through crashes regularly. We go through crashes that we call divorce. We go through crashes that we call our parents becoming elderly. We go through crashes called our teenagers using drugs. We go through crashes called financial insecurity. How do we deal with those and retain a sense of equanimity? That's why I wrote a book.
Yeah, well, how we deal with it is, I guess, highly, highly individual. You know, you talk about a crash. Of course, I had a crash 35 years ago when a truck lost its wheel and crushed my cars before I was a meditator, but I think I would have been hurt anyway.
Yes.
But, you know, the last thing I saw was a black thing in the sky that came in and crushed my car and broke my neck. And I describe it to audiences when I give a talk, and I say, how many people in this room have been hit by a black thing in their lives? Every hand goes up. People over 30, anyway. Mm-hmm. Every hand goes up. We all have the sidewalk pulled out from under us, and we're in free fall. And you're right, Alan. The big question is, what now?
Right.
You know, after the grief and the resentment and righteous indignation, all that stuff.
Well, I came home from a few months in the hospital, and when I came home, I thought, this is it. It's finally over. And to my chagrin, the worst of it was only beginning, because I was incredibly weak physically. I had no use of my hands at that time. I could barely walk. I'm someone who really enjoys giving, and I had to now become completely a receiver. Couldn't feed myself. I couldn't wash myself. I couldn't wipe myself. I couldn't do anything. And all I would say all day long was, I want my life back. I want my life back. And at a certain point, I don't remember when this happened or how it happened, but I began to see that I was not going to have that life back, but I was going to have this life. And there was already so much happening in this life, this new version of my life, that was so good and so loving and so caring and so many opportunities opening up that ultimately, I reached the point of saying, and I still feel this way, that if there was some sort of magic pill that I could take that turned back the clock and I would not have been in that accident, I wouldn't want to go back. Now, don't get me wrong. If I had known before the accident what was going to happen, no, I would not have got on that plane. But what happened, happened. One of the things that you learn in meditation is you learn how to accept that which you can't change. So acceptance, relinquishing that feeling of, I want this back, I want that back. I wasn't going to have that. But the more I would cling to that, the more I suffered. Beginning to let that go was a major transition into what I could do. I could write. I could help people. That's very meaningful in my life.
You know, one of the things I learned, I want to add on to that, is I've learned to help people by asking something of them. When you look in someone's eyes and you say, please help me, those words enrich their lives. And, you know, I've been on both sides of that couch over and over and over again. We both have.
Mm-hmm.
And those three words enrich someone else's lives. And I think that's critical to know as our parents age, you know, and we become very skilled caretakers. Ask something of them, and that's how we get meaning in our lives, right? It's about helping people.
I completely agree with you, because it was also my experience, even though I was reluctant at first. But if I didn't ask for help, I would not have had any food in my mouth because I couldn't do it. But yes, you can see the joy in people's faces when they have an opportunity to help. And that reminded me how much I enjoy helping. So I gave up depriving other people of that opportunity to help me. And I wouldn't have made it through otherwise.
You know, we talk about meditation. We talk about all these factors. Isn't a large part of this the resilience of the human spirit?
Oh, I think it's a major part of it.
What we do, we heal. Given the choice of life and death, we choose life. It's what we do.
Yes. In the book that I wrote, Through the Flames, I referred to the human body as the miraculous human body. Because literally, the moment we cut a finger in the kitchen, it's healing. The minute I was injured, my body was doing everything that it could to heal. It couldn't heal completely. After your accident, your body couldn't heal completely. But it did all that it could do. And then the part about resiliency is different than cure, and it's different than recovery. Healing is the right word. Maybe we can't cure that illness. Maybe we can't recover full use of our body. But we can heal, because that's the mental part.
We heal with scar tissue. I think that's an important caveat.
Yes.
You know, I'm looking. You're wearing gloves, and you know, there's a great deal of scar tissue, I'm sure, all throughout your body, and you're healing at the same time. But the scar tissue is going to stay.
The scar tissue stays, but if it doesn't bother me, it's as if it's not there. You know. In another book that I wrote, I interviewed a friend who's Native American sculptor. Now he's world famous. But when he was 19, he was drafted and sent to Vietnam. There was an explosion. He lost the sight of his eyes and lost most of his right hand, went on and became a famous sculptor. So I was chatting with him one time, and we were watching a video interview with him. And the interviewer used the word handicap with him. And he corrected her, and he said, I'm not handicapped. I just can't see. Mm-hmm. So occasionally I walk into a wall, but who doesn't?
Ah, that's so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's healing. He's healed.
Right, exactly.
He can't see, but he's healed.
I had a patient in my office, Alan, a couple of years ago, and he was going on about the suffering in his life and how he feels so stuck in this moment. And he said, without even thinking, without looking, he said, I just feel so paralyzed. And he looked up at me, and he realized what he said and who he said it to. And I said, you know what? I said, sometimes I feel paralyzed too.
Right, right.
That's the point.
He may be much more paralyzed than you.
Well, we know he suffers at that moment. He suffers more than I do. You've got no PTSD.
No.
How do you understand that?
Well, I think because I was not fully cognizant for so much, my body was traumatized. And by the way, I did do more than a year of trauma therapy, what is now called somatic experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
Highly recommended. Fabulous. Yeah, yeah. But it's my wife who had to look at me. I didn't know how seriously injured I was. I didn't know until almost 2 years later. I was doing a piece for CBS Sunday Morning, and they asked if I had any pictures of me from right after the accident. I knew there were pictures, but I hadn't seen them. Got the pictures. I saw this injured body, and I had not seen that before. When I saw those pictures was the first time I realized why doctors didn't think I would live.
What was your feeling?
When I saw the pictures?
Yeah.
Well, interestingly enough, I immediately looked into the mirror and said, Alan, you're okay now. That was then.
Huh.
It's in the past.
And that's the practice that helps you stay with what's happening now. Alan Locus, I want to thank you so much for joining us. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Alan Locus, author of Through the Flames, Overcoming Disaster Through Compassion, Patience, and Determination. He's also written Patience, The Art of Peaceful Living, and Pocket Peace. He also is the founder and guiding teacher of the Community Meditation Center in New York. We're just going to take a short break right now. We'll be back in 60 seconds. And we are back with our taped show featuring some summer reading suggestions. Voices producer Larry Roebling recommends Healing on the Home Front. It's a book that combines personal storytelling with photojournalism. It's a topic that resonates with me because I've had caregivers for 35 years, some of whom have been with me for decades, and they're not just like family. They are family to me in so many ways. They helped raise my kids, and I was involved in raising theirs. Larry Roebling asked Johan Almquist and Anne DeForest about their process in portraying the intimate relationship between home health care workers and their patients.
I think in the media we often see, you know, health shows are like ER and sort of the mystery of diagnosis and all those kinds of things, when this is really healthcare where it's happening, but it's somewhat invisible because it's personal and really about people that are living in very challenging circumstances. And I think it's also a hidden aspect of healthcare because they're not in the hospitals and because these are people that maybe have conditions that keep them in the homes. You don't know about these stories.
And they're also bound together by need, but also by humanity. And the caregiver, in many instances, seems very happy with their vocation. So I thought it was a really kind of special relationship that, if we could put it into words and pictures, would be very interesting. Most people are truly interested in the human condition.
And you're both approaching this from two different mediums. Anne, you're a writer. Jan, you're a photographer. How did the two of you work together, and how did you get both of these mediums to coalesce for you?
Well, you know, I gave this some thought initially, and, you know, I think that if we were to do it differently, if it were to be done in video, I don't think it would be as strong. I think that the audience needs a little bit of space to fill in the blanks. I think there's a little bit of mystery there. And I think Anne's words and the images are, you know, kind of a nice combination to kind of fill out the personal story.
We've thought a lot about how you tell a story using both words and images. So we had a very similar experience. We were both experiencing the same day, the same time, the family at that same moment. So I think that was a way that things coalesced. We would have conversations in the car on the way back often of what struck us, and that certainly helped me in forming my stories. I don't know if that influenced any of the photos that were chosen for the book, but that was part of the experience as well.
I think we also had a strategy for the images whereby we would shoot the people on neutral backgrounds, no environmental portraiture, so that we would draw out basically the faces and the postures and the gazes of these people. And then we made supplemental to that, we made some kind of environmental black and white kind of more reportage images that would kind of fill in what the home was all about. So I think that that isolation, bringing them out of their environment along with the words, creates that space that I talked about, which I think makes it special.
Well, on the portraits, the faces are so expressive. And I think the choice, your choice of background, just highlighted that.
We chose black for the client or patient, and we chose white for the caregiver. So there's kind of a differentiation through the book.
I also love that you showed the caregiver in their own home, in their space, in their daily life. It was such a great contrast.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks. That was, I think that was really part of the concept, Jan's concept from the very beginning, was that it was home, because it was about home, that it was home and home, that we wanted to find out what were these caregivers' lives like outside of their work life, that it was important for them to have as full a life and as full a full dignity as the people they were caring for, and to get a bigger context. And
yeah, I have to say, too, that, you know, if there was a takeaway from all of this, the caregivers, by and large, throughout this entire project, love what they do, which is incredibly rare. Because I talk to all kinds of people that moan and groan about this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, I don't know what the compensation levels are for these types of things, but I find it amazing that, you know, just universally they're really in love with what they do, and they get a lot of personal satisfaction out of doing it.
I mean, I'm sure that's not the case for every home healthcare worker, but I'm sure in the broad spectrum there must be something that draws people to this.
Sure.
Career.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
I would think so.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, it was one of the things that was striking was how I realized somewhat about halfway through that some of the caregivers were very more difficult interviewees, and I realized that part of the reason was they didn't really like to talk about themselves because they were the type of people who were really focused on the people they took care of, and so you would ask them personal questions, and they were very shy or very modest. And it was so those were more challenging interviews. But when you got them talking about their patients, then they had a lot to say, and they were really excited.
I mean, it's like I said before. I mean, taking care of the physical need is one thing, but then there's a lot more to it than just that. And that's what I think that they respond to, is that they're helping somebody, but they're also developing a bond, and mm-hmm. that bond is important.
There's so many in the book, but tell me a pairing of patient and healthcare worker that was most memorable to you.
There was a young woman named Olivia, and her caregiver was Jackie. So Olivia at the time was 20, and Jackie was 22. So they were only 2 years apart. And Olivia has cerebral palsy, and she had not needed, she was not medically fragile, so she had not qualified for health aid until she turned 18. When she became an adult, she qualified to have an aide. So up until that time, her parents had been doing everything for her, and she had to be lifted. She couldn't walk on her own. And so can you imagine being, you know, 19 years old and not having to go everywhere with your parents? She had never been outside of her house without her parents before. So then she was qualified for to have a aide, and Jackie was paired with her, and they became very close friends and really opened up each other's worlds. That was what was very interesting to me. So on the one hand, here's Jackie, this young nursing student who's hanging out with her patient, who she's become friends with, but also this whole community of other teenagers and young adults with disabilities, you know, going to the mall or going to movies. And so she has her whole world open up to these community that she hadn't really been aware of. And she had gotten a group of her friends from nursing school to volunteer at this organization that Olivia was very involved in, that was kind of a fundraising crafts organization. So I thought that was a really great illustration of what these relationships do.
And you, Jan, who struck you?
I would probably say Scott Mackler, who was a renowned scientist and researcher who ran a lab at Penn, and he had advanced ALS. And my assistant and I walked in there and set up the black background, and we're ready to shoot, and it just does not work at all. There's no eye contact. You know, he can't move. He's on a ventilator. It's very, very difficult and, quite frankly, depressing in a way. So we had to completely rethink the approach. And what we decided to do was actually just shoot into the light and have him be more or less silhouetted against the light. And I think it worked out much better. And what we tried to do was highlight his caregiver, Adam. And there was an incredible relationship between the two of them because he spoke in code. He would blink his eyes for different letters of the alphabet just to get a sentence out. And it was just an incredible relationship that, you know, I was haunted by this photo shoot for months afterwards.
Wow. Yeah. some of the things, Anne, that you just observed. I recall reading about a family that was just doing ordinary family things. I think you even mentioned in the book this is uncommon parenting, but it's around very common things that we do every day.
Again, this is Olivia Ruth. There was this wonderful moment. It was a summer evening, and I walk outside, and there's Olivia in her wheelchair playing lacrosse with her little brother and her father. I think her brother said, you know, show her this. Let's do. And it was something that they would incorporate in their game. They had a long, steep driveway, and Olivia motored up to the top and with the ball, and then she flung it down to her brother, who caught it. And then he said, speed down. She went flying down the driveway in her wheelchair. And it was just so delightful to watch and to see that this is how this family interacted. This is how they lived their lives. And it was not really very different from any other family, except for one of them happened to be in a wheelchair.
So, Jan, how did doing this project change you?
Well, you know, this isn't a normal project for me. I'm, you know, primarily a designer. And, you know, I have educational background in journalism, a master's degree. And it was just one of these things that I just found just an intriguing challenge. And to immerse myself in these stories and these people and to try my best to kind of just honestly portray who they are and what they are. Because I think that they're important stories to tell, and I think that they're underrepresented stories. Most people don't know about these things. And I think that, you know, as time goes on and the baby boomers are getting older, this is going to be more and more of a, you know, a common occurrence. So.
And you, Anne, did this change you at all?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it was one of these projects that really was a gift to me. As a journalist, one of the things I love is that opportunity to experience aspects of life that I might not. We met such a wide range of people, from someone who had, you know, a very premature baby, who was on a ventilator, and, you know, talking about that experience of having to adapt to that situation of, you know, all of a sudden you have this baby and the baby can't come home for a year, and then the baby does come home and has all these severe needs and you have to have round-the-clock nurses in the house. So that was, you know, one end to a woman who was about to die, who was on hospice care. So with everything in between. So that was, I just felt we got such a wide range of human experience in this project, and it was very moving. The other thing is it made me think a lot about what healthcare means and what the importance of it is. And it was really not till the end of the book that I reflected more about the title, because we had chosen this title, Healing on the Home Front, really partly because of it sounded good. I mean, the alliteration, healing and home front. And we decided that we would call the patients healing and the caregivers healers. And after we had finished it, I was thinking, well, is this really the right title? I mean, healing really means you get better. In our society, we think of it as a curing or fixing. And then I thought, no, it's perfect, because healing, for these people, healing is an ongoing process. It's mm-hmm. like healing is their life. Healing is living. And that was an insight that I hadn't had before, and I don't think I would have had if I hadn't written this book and hadn't experienced these lives. So it's really affected the way I look at a lot of things, to think about that idea of what does it mean to heal and how it's an ongoing process and really something that we're all in need of and all part of all the time.
The book is filled from kind of A to Z, from, you know, being born to dying, and it's and short-term care, long-term care, chronic, elder care, hospice, it's all in there.
I'm Larry Roebling, and here with me are Jan Almquist and Anne DeForest talking about their book, Healing on the Home Front. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
This has been our Voices in the Family Summer Reading Show. Thanks to Rachel Simon, author of several books, including Riding the Bus with My Sister, Alan Locos, author of Through the Flames, Our producer, Larry Roebling, spoke with Jorn Almquist and Anne DeForest about their book, Healing on the Home Front, The Faces and Stories of Home Healthcare. And you can find a list of reading suggestions on our website. Or you can follow us on Twitter, we're at Voices in the Fam. Email us at voices@whyy.org. And you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Larry Roebling produces Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Have a good week, my friends.